Welcome to the Corlin Economics Report, a weekly look at financial and political topics relating to asset-based investing. Guests on this program pay no fees to appear, and guests and hosts disclose any equity interest in companies profiled. Now, the Corlin Economics Report.
Hey everyone, welcome in to the weekend edition of the KE Report. In this weekend's edition, we're going to be focusing on the commodities sectors. Man, there are a lot of commodities that continue to perform and a lot of money that has now rotated into a lot of these commodities stocks. The first two segments, we're going to touch on more of the metal side of things, precious metals, base metals. And in the back half of the show, we're moving over to the energy sectors as we have seen a rebound, a strong move actually in oil, and even a bit of a rebound in natural gas. To kick off the show, we're chatting with Nick Hodge, co-owner of Digest Publishing and editor of Foundational Profits and Hodge Family Office. Now, Nick, let's start off with kind of a big picture view here of markets as they tie into commodities. Rotation has been a story over the last about 2.5 years where money seems to stay within the markets and rotate into different sectors, pushing different sectors higher at different times. In the last about month and a half now, it really has been the commodities time to shine as we've seen precious metals, gold and silver move higher. Copper's also moved higher. Uranium was kind of running last year. Nick, let's talk about this rotation trade. Your thoughts on, is this the time early on potentially or even mid-stage where you're seeing money kind of rotate into the commodities because maybe they were the ones that were lagging a lot of the other sectors?
And there's a lot to break off there and chew on. So let me, you know, climb up in my airplane as I typically do and tell you that I think we're in a commodity super cycle that started in 2020. I've told you guys that a couple of times. These super cycles ebbs and flows. Speaking, Corey, to what you were just saying, how, you know, money goes into different things at different times with different drivers. But overall, I think we're in a commodity boom that started 4 years ago. And you saw a bit of a pullback in that over the past, call it 18 months, certainly in things like lithium and PGMs, which I know we'll talk about in a second, while other things have been running. So gold is what you want to know about. I mean, look, it closed the first quarter of 2024, the end of March, you know, above $2,100. That's a real important technical indicator. You know, you talk about money coming into the sector recently. That's what bigger funds, generalist funds, you know, non-resource specific funds, they need to see things like that before they start putting capital to work. So a monthly close, a March close at that $2,100 level for gold was, you know, probably a shot across the bow of some of these the generalist funds to start investing in the sector. The other thing is, you know, inflation is reinflating if you're looking for another driver, right? So we had this narrative that, you know, the inflation was under control, that the Fed was going to begin cutting this year, you know, 3 cuts starting in June. But what's happened is the exact inverse of that in terms of reality and inflation. You know, you've had oil go from 60 some dollars to 80 some dollars. You just mentioned that copper was over 4. I told you, by the way, that it was time for copper to break out in the past couple of months. I told you that was coming and that looks very healthy. So what I'm seeing is in terms of precious metals specifically, they're acting as an inflation hedge, right? With CPI coming out 3.8% recently, you know, the Fed's not going to be able to cut in June. And so I like this kind of market. And I was sort of telling you guys this 2 months ago when I pivoted from, you know, sort of bearish on the broad equities to bullish is that we're not really contingent on the Fed here, right? You know, inflation's doing its thing, growth is doing its thing. And, you know, I don't think a quarter point, you know, cut from the Fed in June or July is really what investors are focusing on here. I think they're focusing on more fundamental drivers like inflation and growth. And that's what gold is pricing in. So I'd have to tell you that with a strong CPI number out this week, you know, people are saying, though, the Fed's not going to be able to cut. The dollar had a really strong pop. And yet gold is just sort of hovering, right? Look, it just actually is teetering as I'm talking right now. It's going from green to red on my screen. So gold is bullish. Inflation is reinflating. And I think we're in a commodity super cycle that started 4 years ago and is going to last another 5 years. So, and now other things are going to start to join the party again in ebbs and flows. So happy to talk about some of those things if you want. And hopefully that was a decent answer to what was a pretty broad question.
Yeah, Nick, it is a pretty broad concept, the commodity super cycle and the commodities taking off. But as you say, across the board, we're seeing pops in a lot of these. Let's just focus in on gold and the precious metal sector for a little longer, though. And when you look at gold, it's been breaking higher despite a relatively strong dollar and despite what was happening in interest rates, and shrugged off one of the most aggressive tightening cycles that we've seen in a long period of time for decades. So all things considered, gold has done great, but what's been buoying the gold price has been central bank buying. Now, central banks don't buy silver, and they don't buy gold stocks or silver stocks. So what's been exciting recently is that silver has finally popped its head up above that $26 resistance level. Now it's up above $28. And the precious mining stocks, not just the majors and the mid-tiers, but even all the way down in the juniors, have finally started to move. So what is your read on where we're at in the precious metal cycle right now?
Well, you're bullish. And so silver is starting to turn bullish as well. You know, I like for gold to confirm. And then I start looking at silver, and silver was acting more industrial here until recently. I think that you've got inflation worries percolating through the market. I think that you've got people interested in buying gold and silver, you know, partially in the U.S. I keep seeing this, you know, story about Costco selling its gold bars. I think Wells Fargo just said they're selling some $200 million worth of them. But certainly globally, you know, China and India likes to buy gold and silver. And what I've seen recently is silver decoupling from being an industrial metal and becoming, you know, more of a precious metal. And I guess let's drill down on that for a second. A couple of things going on there. One that really drives it home for me is clean energy has been weak. So if we've been talking about, you know, a bull market. I've told you I've gotten bullish in broad-based equities, even on AI and some tech stocks I've been owning and recommending. What I haven't been as bullish on and what's not worked as well in the market is, you know, these clean energy stocks, solar stocks, wind stocks, hydrogen. And for a while, I was hearing, you know, from the silver permabulls, I have to laugh because, you know, it was silver time since Wall Street silver 3 years ago, and it went absolutely nowhere. And there was always some driver, right? Most recently, it was solar stocks are going to drive silver to the moon, right? I don't necessarily think that's the case, right? And I don't think solar just breached 26 or 27, you know, on the back of solar deployments globally. What I think that is driving silver up is inflation fears and traditional drivers of precious metals. And so to me, it's not that complicated in my mind. You've got silver now not acting industrial and acting more as a precious metal. And that means it's time to buy it in my mind. And so as I've explained to you, we've been doing these talks for a while now. You probably know how I go about things. I'll start with a silver ETF, a pure commodity ETF. Is sort of a prodding attack, which I've mentioned before, make sure I'm right, and then start going into the equities. You know, if for silver, I'm not an expert. I'm more of a generalist. So I do things, you know, like Mag Silver, for example, is an easy one to get into when silver starts turning bullish. But as far as where we are in the cycle, I mean, I can't tell you how long the cycle is going to last. What I can tell you is that inflation is going to continue to persist higher than, you know, the government, the Fed and the Biden administration want. And that's going to benefit things like gold, silver, other commodities and crypto to a certain extent. So, you know, even my partner, Gerardo Del Real, who you guys might know, was asking me as recently as a month or two ago if it's time to buy silver. And I was telling him no. So I guess what I'm saying is I'm willing to change my mind. And since we've talked last, the three of us, I've changed my mind on silver. And I'm not right all the time. No one is, right? I told you also last time, you know, the guy who buys the absolute bottom and sells the absolute top is an absolute liar. So did I miss the bottom in silver? Yeah, maybe. Do I care? No, because I can buy it now and it's bullish and it can go higher. And so I guess a couple of remarks there about how I think about silver and how I think about investing generally. So yeah, silver, less industrial, more precious metal, and getting bullish for sure.
Nick, can we drive down to some of the juniors, gold and silver juniors? Because broadly, a lot of these have, let's say, about doubled from some of their lows just at the very end of February. We're seeing a lot of financings come out, but quite frankly, a $2 million financing, that's still just lights on money. I know you sometimes get into these financings. How are you viewing the juniors, their rebound, which it has been a double, but hasn't done much for the long-term charts, and now a lot more companies coming out and financing?
Well, you know, I feel like a crypto investor because I'm hodling my junior gold and silver stocks. Last month, I was saying that one of the things I wanted to be cautious of was not selling too soon. And that happens sometimes in this space, especially if you buy too soon, right? And buying too soon is also known as being wrong. And what happens is you end up underwater for so long that once you get an uptick, like we've seen over the past month, you're in a rush to get out. So I continue to warn against that to my readers and also to myself. And I'll give you one example. And then we can go from there. A company I've been involved in for a while, a long time, like a decade, is Perpetua Resources. It used to be called Midas Gold. They've been in a permitting process for 7 or 8 years in Idaho, and I was involved in the stock before that. And it's gone absolutely nowhere. You know, they've rolled back, et cetera, et cetera. You know, the stock was recently down at $3 or $4 Canadian and has just been languishing there. I mean, right, no catalyst, delays in permitting. It had drifted down from like $10 to, I'm looking at it now, a low of $3.50. That $3.50 low was hit, by the way, at the end of February, so less than 2 months ago. And I remember a mentor of mine telling me, you know, when you get a bull market, people are going to be fighting over this thing at $10 or $15 when no one wanted to buy it at $3 or $4, right? That's sort of how resources work. And lo and behold, what happens? They're scheduled to get their permit this quarter. We'll see if it happens. But they got money from the Department of Defense. And then this week or last week, I guess it was, they announced an indication of a $1.8 billion loan from the Export-Import Bank to build this thing, and shares leapt to over $9. Remember what I just said. This was a $3.50 stock in February. It's a $9 stock as I look at it right now. They haven't even got their permit yet. And so, you know, I was talking to my partner and my mentor. It was, you know, I've now doubled my money quickly in the past 30 or 45 days. And I was talking about taking profits, and they advised me what I was just advising you. This thing doesn't even have a permit yet, right? There's a lot further to run up. So, you know, let these winners run. Now, that's a bigger name that's in permitting, right? We're gonna start to construct this thing soon. That's a lot different than, you know, a $2.5 million or a $5 million market cap company on the smaller end of the spectrum. Those are the guys across the board that tend to raise money when the prices tick up because, you know, juniors are always burning money. They're not generating any revenue. So they always need to raise money to keep moving forward. When you get an uptick in the prices is when they tend to take advantage of that. And that can, you know, sometimes not be good for retail shareholders. So I think I was telling you guys last month when I was looking at my financings, you know, my warrants were starting to expire because some of these things I had financed 2-3 years ago, and if they had a 2 or 3 year warrant, that's coming up for expiration and likely not in the money yet, you know, despite the good month of March and April that we had in the resource space. So I will start to write checks into these companies. So I can get that warrant extension is primarily what I'm looking for. I want to be able to have exposure in the future because I don't have a crystal ball that lets me know how it is going to play out. And so, yes, I will start financing into these companies. I guess another thing I would say is that it just speaks to the illiquidity of the sector, how these stocks have gone up here in the past month or two, right? So, you know, you look at some of these 10 or 15 centers, and you do the dollar volume math, right? Like look at their volume, how many shares traded hands times the price, right? And you'll see that some of these stocks are doubling on $30,000 or $50,000 worth of buying. And so I think it's still really early in the cycle. You know, you look at the stocks versus the gold price, they still got a lot of upside left. And so I'm feeling bullish and I'm trying to prevent myself from selling too soon. I forget what the question was. Sorry.
Well, it was a great answer, Nick, and it's a great point to not to sell too soon and that we are still early in this process. And to your point, a lot of these stocks are moving up, but on very low volume. So there's not a mania in the space, far from it, and there's probably a lot longer to run. And maybe some of those warrants and new financings, you get another 2 or 3 year window here, they'll be in the money this time. So definitely some good momentum going in the precious metal space. Let's toggle over to copper, though. The good doctor, Dr. Copper, finally breaking above four. It really now up in the 420s, almost at 430, and getting close to that same level that we saw just last year as a peak. Now, you were not table pounding bullish, Nick, and I want to give you credit because for years, everybody's been pounding the table on copper, 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 and it's finally looking like this is a move that's going to be a more sustainable run. Even the copper stocks, if you look at the producers and COPEX, or I know you mentioned last time you're in ICOP, That new fund. There's actually a lot of new copper ETFs now with COPP from Sprott and COPJ from Sprott for the junior. So you got four copper ETFs, more momentum in the space. How are you playing it? Are you just in the producers or are you delving down into the juniors too?
Yeah, that ETF's up 20% in the past month, by the way, since I bought it and talked to you guys about it. That's good work if you can get it on a mainstream listed ETF. That just goes to show why timing matters. If you remember, I told you I bought that ETF because I thought China was going to be one of the main drivers behind this, you know, rising copper price, this reinflation of commodity prices where China's sort of been closed off for the past couple of years. And so we did go into ICOP, and that's worked out well. I own other copper juniors for sure that I financed privately. Last month, I was telling you about Hannon as my example. That stock's up 90% in the past month. They announced another copper gold porphyry target just this morning before we spoke. They'll likely, you know, back to financings on the last question, they'll likely be raising money in May, and I'll recommend that financing and we'll write a check into it. I think I also told you about Gladiator as another small stock I'm in. Gladiator Metals up in the Yukon. That's another stock that's added, you know, 5 or 7 cents from a 30-cent base here in the past couple of weeks. So I own them differently, and I try to make myself clear, and I feel like I don't sometimes. But on the junior side, I tend to buy and hold for a long time. I get access to cheap financings. I get access early in life cycles. And these things take a long time to play out. And so I have them in my portfolio and I finance them over time. They're starting to move now. I think the other thing I told you is that I do these priming attacks, right? So I bought the ICOP. And now that I've been proven correct, I'll look to get more aggressive, right? So I'll look to get into individual names like the Ivanhoes and the Southern Coppers and the Philos of the world. And I'm going through some of those right now. And it's sort of funny just to sort of, you know, watch how these things play out if you know what to look for in real time, given that, you know, everyone is on Twitter and social media. I see that Mr. Friedland is getting his promoter's hat dusted off as well, you know, going back on the Twitter and talking about Ivanhoe, et cetera. And so, yeah, these copper stocks are looking really good. It's time to start, you know, matriculating into the individual larger names and then, you know, continue writing checks into these copper juniors as I sort of just laid out. What's changed, I guess, is maybe an interesting question. What's changed for me? I didn't write that many checks last year. That's probably what changes for me. I get back into check writing mode, and then I get back into, you know, open market buying mode. Like I just said, you know, percolating into these different large copper producers that are liquid while keeping my sort of stable of copper juniors close to me that I invest and fund and keep going. Just another point on that, not necessarily on copper specifically, but just on market dynamics and flows and time frames and, you know, being a real resource investor. Look, I financed Revival Gold. You guys may have come across it. This is a company with 4 million ounces in Idaho. I remember writing my first check into that company because I did it while I was moving across the country. I was literally driving across the country when I wrote my first check into that company. It was 2017. So it's 2024. And just this week, that company announced it's, you know, it's making an acquisition of a gold asset in Utah. So these stories take years, sometimes decade or more to play out. And in the case of copper specifically, you can know all the things that you sort of said, Shad, that people are pounding the table on copper. There's going to be a deficit, the EV revolution, this, that, and the other thing. Like, we know it's coming. And so that's why I fund ongoing, you know, these copper juniors, and I stay in the game, give myself exposure, and then can get bigger. Cause like you said, they're going to raise money when it's actually time. And then I use those liquid vehicles, ETFs, more in my retirement accounts, just as a generalist investor, like buying them when it's time to get bullish on copper, for example. So it's different styles, different mentalities, different philosophies of investing. And I hope I don't confuse your listeners and my readers when I write about them, but that's how I think about markets and that's how I execute. And it's different because I do them in different accounts, right? Like I have multiple brokerage accounts, I have multiple IRAs, et cetera. And what I'm doing in one might be for one reason, and it might be different than why I'm financing a copper junior. So that's how I just think about capital and how I think about markets and how I manage my accounts overall.
I've got one more on the copper stocks, and I think it was funny that you brought up Revival, because I went to a site visit, man, years and years ago. That company's still around, and yeah, as you said, now diversifying. When it comes to copper stocks that have pounds in the ground, where there are a number of them, what separates the higher quality ones for you? These aren't exploration stocks. These are stocks that have defined resources that, in all fairness, you can find companies like this in almost every jurisdiction around the world. So how do you do your due diligence on these?
Yeah, so one is structure. How is the company structured? I'm a big structure guy. I tend to look at that first. So who are the partners? How much did insiders pay for their shares, et cetera? So structure is a big thing. And then leadership and management. And, you know, I give you one example, I guess, just because we're talking about copper. So I've been in Aldebaran Resources for a couple of years, have written a check or two in there and have bought shares in the open market. That checks all the boxes I just told you. They've got Route One, who is a big, you know, mining finance company that has a significant stake. They've got South 32, who has a significant stake. They've got Sibanye, who has a stake as well. They've been sort of letting themselves get diluted out a bit. But nonetheless, you got South 32 and Route One. So that's the sort of the structure and the partners. This is an asset in Argentina, by the way, very large, drilled out asset, has a resource. We'll have a resource update coming here in the second half of 2024. But then you've got leadership in John Black, who has, you know, sold a copper company before for hundreds of millions of dollars. And so you have a team that's been through cycles and has sold assets and knows how to deal with majors. And so, you know, if we're comparing apples and apples, that's how I would differentiate.
All right, Nick. Hey, awesome chatting with you. Thank you again for focusing a bit more on the metals, the commodities, the runs that we have seen, and diving down into some of those stocks that you are interested in. Look, these are some of the bigger commodity sectors out there, and these stocks have really started to bounce. Majors and now even down into the juniors just in the last couple of weeks. I know it has a lot of investors wondering, has this run gone too far? We are due for a pullback. What does a pullback look like? And how much higher could these go? Just look at a long-term chart and it shows you how much upside these stocks potentially have if we are in this commodity super cycle as you laid out. Nick, thank you very much for taking time on this weekend show. Everyone, stick around. We're going to be right back with Joseph Schachter focusing on the energy sector.
Thank you both.
Al Corlin's firm, A.B. Corlin & Associates Incorporated, provides consulting services to public companies on matters of regulatory compliance. To find out more, follow the link from www.kereport.com. The Corlin Economics Report will be back after this brief timeout. Providing unique reporting on markets and companies since 1990. This is the Corlin Economics Report.
All right, welcome back. Continuing to listen to the weekend edition of the KE Report. And as promised, we're shifting our focus to the energy sectors. We're chatting with Joseph Schachter, founder and editor of the Schachter Energy Report. Also a free report called Eye on Energy, where Joseph covers more of the fundamental drivers in terms of published data for oil and natural gas. We're going to start off by talking, again, more on these fundamentals, what Joseph thinks is driving the oil move up to the mid-80s, and natural gas at least a little rebound into about the $1.80 range. But still a lot of catching up potentially for natural gas compared to what oil has done. But again, very different markets. Joseph, let's start off with that move in oil as we are recording this on Thursday later in the day. Crude is up to, well, right about $85, off a little bit today, but it's been quite a strong run for crude in terms of the data that you are reading, what you think is driving this market. Please share with us, what are these fundamental drivers behind this move higher?
Well, there were a number of drivers that pushed it up. Originally, it was the OPEC, you know, putting in limits on their production, where they did do some cutbacks, but never as large as what they were talking about being the 2.2 million barrels. It was more like 400,000 or 500,000, but it was a cut. The second, of course, was winter, where you had strong demand. but that's, you know, ending, even though there's still snow in Calgary. And third was the situation going on in the Middle East with the attack in October and then Israel's war against Hamas in Gaza. And it pushed the price of oil up to, you know, about $88. Today, we're down $1.20 to about $85. And the reason is yesterday's EIA report showed a very big build in inventories, 13 million barrels. And we now have some of the subsets of it showing that they're above last year's inventory levels. And I'll give you a couple examples. For example, you have the commercial stocks were up 5.8 million. Motor gasoline was up 700,000, but it's up 6.3 million from a year ago. And then distillate fuels is up 1.7 million, and that's up 5.3 million barrels from a year ago. If we go to total stocks, you're looking at 13 million barrels, and we're only 12.5 million below a year ago. So again, a couple more weeks of this, and we're in the shoulder season, where after the strong winter demand, you go into a period where global demand falls off by 2 to 2.5 million. So if we have an average of, let's say, 102 for the year, you might go below 100, 98, 99 maybe at the low during those shoulder seasons of spring and fall. And then when you get into the summer, you might be 103, 104. And then at the end of this year, you'll probably be again at the same when we have winter 2024, 2025. The other key point of interest in the report was that exports came down. The U.S. has been a very big exporter of light crude, and you know, countries around the world would, of course, love to buy from the U.S. if they have, especially if they have deficits in trade or surpluses in trade. Sorry, and they need to tighten that up with the U.S. So they would buy U.S. crude versus other crudes, and with the, you know, transportation advantages as well. But exports fell 1.3 million barrels from 4 million to 2.7, which tells you that there's an adequate supply of oil around the world right now. And with shoulder season underway, if the U.S. Consumption is down, which it was, it fell 2 million barrels from 21.3 to 19.2. And if China demand is weak, then you're seeing that we're seeing a softness in demand in the two largest economies in the world. And the biggest, you know, China's the biggest importer and the United States is the biggest producer and consumer. That tells you that prices could back off, except for what's going on in terms of the geopolitical situation and the concern right now that after Israel killed two Iranian generals in a consulate in Damascus, historically, when you're at war, you never attack diplomatic missions, be they embassies or consulates. Israel did that to get after this general that was controlling all of the terrorist organizations in Syria and Lebanon and working with Hamas in Gaza. And there was another killing just, you know, yesterday of, you know, three more militants tied to one of the leaders in living in Qatar, I think. So there's a political and war situation has kept prices up, even though, as I said, we're down today over a dollar. But I think that the price of $85, based on the fundamentals, should go below 80, and there'll still be a war premium in there, maybe 10, 12 bucks. But if for some reason the war situation stabilizes and Biden is able to arm twist Netanyahu to not invade Rafah, and there's some kind of a hostage deal that cools things down with a ceasefire, we could see a lot of that war premium come down. And so there is a window between now and the summer driving season at the end of June for the price of crude to not only break 80, but potentially even break 70.
Well, and Joseph, with that in mind, if oil could hit this softer patch between now and the summer driving season, and like you say, break 80 and possibly even break 70, what does that mean for the oily stocks? Because they've been on a blistering run higher. I usually look at things through the lens of XLE, the big ETF, and it's been making all-time highs and honestly was continuing to blaze higher even when oil was trending sideways. It's just now has maybe started to roll over, and we've seen that in the small caps and XOP. Do you think if we saw that pullback in price that this is a good profit-taking moment for energy investors?
I think because of the large caps being the XLE, it reached 98.47 on the high It's down, you know, to 97.43 today, but, you know, it could go down, you know, below 80 if we do see the price of crude break 70. So to take profits makes a lot of sense to me. Some of our favorite names have had such great runs. You know, we had Whitecap in the low eights, and now it was over 10.5 earlier today. So that was a very nice move. And then you had a surge, which was under $6, and it got over $8. That was one of our top picks, and it did very well. So there's been some great moves in the oily sector, and if we bust 80, they're going to go down. And, you know, and then depending upon what happens in the Middle East, we could go much lower. But again, the window is till the summer driving season. I think once we are in the summer driving season, I think we will see 80s and maybe even 90s. And in our forecast, we're even assuming in Q4 that supply and demand tighten up quite a bit, and we see prices even peaking over 100, not for the whole quarter, but you may see a few days in that, you know, three-month window that are where we see price trading over 100 simply because the supply-demand situation tightens up, because most companies are just focusing on replacing their decline rates. And maybe if you're a growth mode, you might be 3-5%. So there's not going to be a lot of new production coming on in, you know, in 2024, 25. And if OPEC is, you know, keeps their quotas, as they say, and don't bring back a lot of production. And Russia, of course, has problems now with all the attacks on its refineries and production facilities shipping through the Black Sea. We could see that $100. And if, you know, there's a war event somewhere, you know, China, Taiwan, you know, Russia has more success in their fight in Ukraine, in eastern part of the country. If Lebanon, Hezbollah get involved with direct attacks on Israel, all of that war premium can expand. We've had in the past war premiums $30 or $40 when Saddam Hussein invaded Kuwait. So, you know, right now I would say there's a $10 to $15 war premium there, but that war premium can shrink or that war premium can expand depending upon how bad the hostilities are.
What are your thoughts on some of the smaller energy stocks? Because those have started to do a bit better, but again, they're not close to even breaking out to all-time highs. I don't even think many of them, actually some of them are at right around 52-week highs. So that's a bit more encouraging, but still a lot more upside to go. They've also traded generally lower volumes from what I've seen. Any interest in some of the smaller cap stocks to add a little more torque to the upside when you do get that other buying signal?
Yeah, we like, you know, names like Bonterra that has a high oil content, Hemisphere, In-Play Oil, you know, Questair Energy, Rubellite, you know, Valura. And there's others that have a higher oil weighting, you know, Surge Energy's 86% liquids. So you can have those stocks do better, you know, because, the generalists, when they come in, they go to the CNQs, they go to the Suncors, Imperial Oil, Cenovus, MEG, and then they work their way down. And we just had the BMO Cap Conference on Tuesday and Wednesday in Toronto, and a lot of generalist portfolio managers were there, and there were a lot of one-on-one meetings that the companies told me they had with people they hadn't seen for a while, because the generalists weren't interested in the sector. And that's why the oily names have done well. A couple of the service stocks like CES Energy Solutions had a good week because of the conference. It reached a high this week of 571, which is the 52-week high. This was a $2.30 stock at the low. So we are seeing some action in the service sector. One of my favorite names is Trican. It got up to 451. This was a stock that was under $3 at the low this year. So, and you know, it's not near its high, which was 533, but it's 451, and it's up today when a lot of the companies are down. Because if we start seeing a lot more activity once you know, TMX line is on, which is imminent, and then the Coastal Gas line comes on in Q4 with LNG Canada, the activity level to drill to fill is going to you know, pick up the service sector. activity level, and that's going to cause profitability, you know, as your utilization of your equipment goes up and your day rates even have some chance to move up, the total return becomes very good for energy service companies.
I'm glad you brought up the energy services companies, because I was looking at OIH as another ETF and noticed that it had had a pretty good move recently. It was rolling over. But to your point, if the LNG Canada terminals come on, that could be a new life for that sector. Let's talk a little bit more about NatGas, though, and the NatGas stocks. I know that right now we have a lot of interest, people writing us in questions asking about, has NatGas finally bottomed? When will it get moving? What about the stocks? What's your take on that, Joseph?
Well, you know, NatGas historically backs off this time of year. You know, winter demand is over to the most part. You know, you had a 37 BCF drawdown last Thursday. I haven't pulled out the data from today yet. You know, withdrawal season is the end of April, ends in April, and then we start building. But we have very high storage levels for NatGas and also in Canada and the States. In the U.S., I just got the data from last week. It's 2.26 TCF, and you want to normally be under 2 TCF at the end of the year. A year ago, we were at 1.84 TCF, and the five-year average is 1.5 TCF. So we're looking at very big storage numbers, and until we get more LNG exports out of the States, you know, we are seeing a decline in production in a number of places in the U.S., in the Appalachia area. The problem we have is everybody's drilling for light oil in the Permian, and as a byproduct, you have natural gas. So the companies there are selling natural gas or giving it away at it, or even paying somebody to take it. So negative pricing, because they're making so much money on the light oil, you know, at $85 a barrel. In Canada, natural gas is still, you know, sloppy at the $1.60-$1.70 range, because the same thing, if you're an oil producer and you're getting $85 US, multiply that by 1.36 or whatever the Canadian exchange rate is today, and you're making out really, really well, that if the byproduct natural gas doesn't make you any money, you don't really care. And so it hurts the dry natural gas guys who don't have that liquids support.
Joseph, how do you go about analyzing these companies then that do have that natural gas kicker? But as you just mentioned, it can vary between what that offtake or what that extra product is. How much does that filter into your analysis of these companies?
Well, I always look at the mix of the business. We do up an NAV with the same pricing comparison, you know, right across the board between large cap, small cap, and we have a discount for heavy oil versus light oil. And then we come up with NAVs. And right now, you know, the NAVs of many of these companies, they're trading at significant discounts. For example, I know you guys know Petrus quite well. The company has a $4.02 NAV at the end of 2023. The stock trades at $1.32. One of the oily names, Bonterra, which is a junior, trading at $6.77 when I did this run. I think it's a bit higher today, but it has an NAV of $21.28. So you look at all those numbers and the mix, and then you look at the, you know, the way the market is trading. I prefer to buy stocks when the market is ignoring the area and they're very, very cheap. And, you know, we've had many, many times like that December of last year. We've had a couple times this year already. And I think that right now we've had a frenzy. And if the price of oil backs off below 80, we're going to see, you know, a pullback right across the board, with the most air being those large cap oily names that the big generalist institutions chased up here, and they pushed them up to what I consider lofty levels if we have a break of $80 WTI.
Well, Joseph, just summarizing kind of the themes in the market here, if the oily names, especially the biggest ones, the largest cap stocks, could have a little more downside pressure, and if some of the small caps or some of the oil services, and in particular the nat gas stocks, have a little more upside, does it make sense to just do a rotation trade and pull some money out of the biggest oil names and put it into nat gas stocks or oil services stocks?
Yeah, because you've got some very nice dividends there as well. You know, if you look at you know, a company like Inplay, which is, you know, 59% liquids, you know, they're paying a 7% dividend yield. Petrus is paying a 9% dividend yield, a penny a month. You know, so you've got some very, very healthy. Surge pays, you know, 4 cents a month, 6% dividend yield. So you've got companies that are giving you reasonable yields, that have a nice mix of both oil and natural gas. And that's, I think, a good rotation. But if you're a little more nimble, you might want to wait for the correction because you might save 10% or more on the natural gas weighted or energy service names. You know, if we have a 15-20% overall correction in the energy sector over the next couple of months.
So, Joseph, how sustainable are these dividends, though? If, let's just say, natural gas stays sub $2, kind of in the range that it's in now, and if oil does correct like you think it might?
Yeah, I think the, you know, the natural gas, you know, may back off a little bit more because of this, you know, during the summertime, unless the air conditioning demand is strong. But remember, September and LNG Canada is not that far away. So, you know, we may have some ruckus and, you know, and weaker prices in the short term. But anytime you see bargains in the sector, you want to nibble away at them. You know, we had tremendous bargains in the oily side going back when we had oil sub $70, which was not that long ago. What was that, November, December? And we got, there were a lot of bargains, and a lot of those stocks are up 30 to 50% from those lows. If they back off, you know, 20% from here, you know, there'll be buys. And if we do see $90 with peaking over 100 in Q4 for oil, if we get 250 plus for gas, remember, a lot of the natural gas companies have been doing hedging. And if you look at the forward curve for winter of 24-25, you've got pricing in there over $3. So, you know, companies that are doing appropriate hedging, 25 to 40% of their business, so that they have their CapEx program taken care of. If you're at the higher end, also because you have a dividend, you want to protect that. And then you leave some for better pricing if there is that. Companies that don't hedge are the ones that are going to be more vulnerable to low prices. But some of them are trading at such discounts to their NAV. For example, one of the names that we've liked and talked about many times in the past is Birchcliff, which trades around $5.50. Its NAV is $24.22. So, you know, if it, in the next 2 to 3 years, if it just gets to its NAV, we're looking at a, you know, a four bagger plus.
Well, Joseph, another big theme from 2023 was M&A in the oil and gas sector. We saw a lot of big deals and we saw a couple mid-cap deals. We haven't seen as much in 2024. Do you think with the big boost that a lot of the mega cap stocks have right now, where they could use their equity as their currency, that we'll start seeing a pickup in M&A deals?
The problem you have is the expectations between the buyer and the seller. And talking to companies, as I am right now, because we're having you know, updates on the companies and also talking to them about coming to the Catch the Energy conference in October, they're saying that there's packages out there, but the expectations of the sellers is much too high, because they're looking out at you know, $85 oil, maybe going to 100, and they're looking at Coastal coming on and $253 gas. So they want to be paid for part of it. They know they're not going to get all of it, because people use long-term pricing, not just peak pricing in their evaluations of asset purchases. But there's a big gap there. But if we do get into 2025 and we have these higher prices and it looks like they're going to go higher and they're sustainable, then it's very likely that we'll see more deal flow at the end of the year. And especially the big companies that are, let's say, part of LNG Canada and other LNG projects, many of them do not have enough gas to support the projects. They have to go out and buy gas from the market, or they buy companies and grab their reserves. So there's companies out there like in BC Crew, you know, you've got so many companies, you know, that have large gas reserves. We saw last year Pipestone get taken over by Strathcona. My guess is we're going to see more deal flow. Right now, from what I'm hearing from the industry, the 2.1 BCF that LNG Canada has for train number one is about 800 million a day short of gas controlled or owned by the owners of LNG Canada, which means they're doing deals. You know, you may have seen the deal that Pembina just did with Cedars for 200 million a day. So, you know, companies are trying to lock in supply. Tourmaline's done a deal with Rockies LNG. So the companies are being, you know, locking in at favorable pricing into these LNG companies. But the LNG companies, especially the big multinationals, at some point may decide they would like to buy the reserves. and we may see more takeovers at that point.
All right, Joseph, thank you very much for your insights here. Very interesting, you know, how much we appreciate looking at the energy sector and just how well a lot of these companies, these stocks, especially the big ones, have done. And this rally in oil, mid-80s, it's a strong price for these companies that continue to generate very nice cash. I hope all of you enjoyed this weekend show. Thank you so much for tuning in. Again, a bit more of a focus on the resource sectors. That is a broad sector that has continued to run in the last couple months, especially in the stocks starting to play catch up, especially on the precious metals front, to those underlying prices. Everyone, please go back through our website and podcast and YouTube page under The KE Report to listen to all our daily editorials and company updates. Keep in touch with us. We'll be back with you on Monday and be back on the weekend show next Saturday. Hope you all have a great rest of your weekend. Joseph, thanks again for joining us.
My pleasure.